Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
Hey, kids, let's get healthy, fight disease, and eat right. Have a big bowl of worms with me, won't you?
No, and slimy and so fat, juicy ones, and the fizzy, wuzzy worms.
Turns out worms can be our friends even if they live inside us. Platyhelminths have a bad rap. Worms are healers. That's Dr. Worm to you on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everybody. It's Thursday, January 29th. Adora Udoji is away. No lie, worms are healers. We'll tell you more about that. We're also going to talk about the expensive stimulus package, $819 billion and counting, on its way to the Senate. Also, dirt cheap sports tickets. It's the sale of the century. Let's get right to the headlines. President Obama's stimulus package has passed the House, but not the way the White House wanted. Not one Republican House member voted for it. California Republican Ken Calvert says the bill has too much spending and not enough tax cuts. Cutting.
The strategy under this bill is to throw billions of dollars in every bureaucratic direction, cross our fingers, and hope for the best.
Well, that sentiment despite a fierce White House lobbying campaign. A handful of Democrats also voted against the bill. The stimulus plan is now in the Senate. Debate could start next week. At the bottom of the hour, we'll get a clearer picture of the economy that the bill hopes to fix. New numbers are out. The weekly jobless claims number comes out. Durable goods orders comes out. We're watching for those. We'll let you know what they all say. Femi Oke is here with some of the other headlines. Before I strangle, why don't you get with it?
I'll help you out. Governor Rod Blagojevich's impeachment trial will actually have Blagojevich present today. He skipped the trial all week, opting instead for interview after interview on TV. He won't be under oath and won't answer questions. He'll give a speech as a closing argument and he'll have a full 90 minutes to do it in. U.S. Special Envoy George Mitchell wants Israel to know that the new White House still supports it.
President Obama has said that the United States is committed to Israel's security and to its right to defend itself against legitimate threats.
But Mitchell also wants Israel to get moving on the peace process. Today he visits West Bank Palestinians. He's not planning to see leaders of Gaza-based Hamas. Mitchell got this mission because he did a good job with the Northern Ireland peace process. Irish nationalist leader Gerry Adams was there, and John, you'll be talking to him. And we'll see if he thinks Mitchell can succeed in the Middle East.
Well, it's interesting. They're good friends. They are really good friends. Gerry Adams and George Mitchell are good friends. We'll see if he can have buddies out of the Palestinians and the Israelis and Hamas. That'll be quite
a
challenge.
Looking forward to that.
Yes, indeed. Later on in the program. So the Dow begins at 83.75 this morning. 2.5% gain yesterday. The S&P grew 3.33% yesterday. It begins trading at 8.75. Could be a rally, but we'll find out when the markets open on Wall Street in an hour and a half. But we want to know what, in tough economic times, the big ticket items are going for. Is it 70% off? Is it 50% off?
I was in an outlet or a Marshall's and I bought a pair of pants for $3. Those pants would have probably cost me more like 50.
Give us some advice. Are you restocking your closet on super sales? In these economic times, where are the deals? Tell us in your neighborhood at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Well, we got ourselves a stimulus package. It's an actual real bill, and it's passed by the House. It's on its way to the Senate. It passed last night in the House after a debate, 244-188. And that was despite President Obama's attempts at getting bipartisan participation on the bill. Look at the numbers closely. This is President Obama yesterday on Capitol Hill.
What makes an idea sound is not whether it's Democrat or Republican, but whether it makes good economic sense for their workers and companies. And they understand that when it comes to rebuilding our economy, we don't have a moment to spare.
Well, whether he likes it or not, this bill coming out of the House is definitely a Democratic idea. Not a single Republican vote was there at the end when it passed 244 to 188. Chris Hayes joins us. He's the Washington, D.C. editor of The Nation. And Chris Hayes, we've had a couple of discussions about the theory of stimulus. Now we're looking at the practice. What do you see in this bill that's economically sound and particularly something that might answer some of your objections to the way stimulus was talked about in the waning days of the Bush administration?
Well, I mean, stimulus wasn't really taken quite very seriously at all in the waning days of the Bush administration. I mean, it was essentially a pretext for more of the same, which was the tax cuts, which they had always advocated no matter what the situation. So I think the infrastructure spending is not quite as large as I would like to see, but what there is in there is very good. The spending that's going to go towards broadband is particularly encouraging, and the green energy stuff. I think the stuff that's in there around weatherization of federal buildings, as boring as that sounds, is actually really, really, really good.
All right, well, explain. You've used really three times there. Why would that be really, really, really good? And I suspect there are some serious jobs behind that.
Yeah, I mean, look, what you want to do is you're in this situation in which there's two imperatives. One is to spend a lot of money to boost aggregate demand and to stop essentially the free fall of the economy and for these really vicious cycles to kick in, which unfortunately have already kicked in. But while you're spending this money, I mean, there's good and bad ways to spend it. At a certain level, you can do what Keynes suggested back when he first started talking about this kind of spending, which is, you know, stick dollar bills inside bottles and throw them down coal mines. Shafts, and that would have some stimulative effect because it would induce a certain amount of demand and activity, but that wouldn't necessarily bear any long-term fruit in terms of investment.
Right, Chris. I mean, I know all that, and that's not because I'm trying to be Mr. Smarty this morning, but I would love to know, and this is what I yearn for when I look at these places in the bill where they talk about specific earmarked projects, of how it does break down, how much of the material that would be bought is American material, weather stripping for federal buildings, for
sure.
Instance, how much of the contracting jobs would have to be done locally and bring in people who are already unemployed and feeling some distress. Can you help me with that?
Well, no, I mean, I can't. I mean, partly because it's a very, very long bill that passed yesterday, and I haven't read the whole thing in fine-grained detail. I do think that in the Senate, Sherrod Brown has this Buy American provision, which I think is probably going to come to the floor in an amendment. And in terms of these construction jobs, I mean, the reason they're good from a stimulative perspective is this: A, they're labor-intensive, and B, they can't be outsourced. So there's not going to be any kind of leakage there. Look, the devil's going to be in the details in terms of how the contracting happens, and I think that that's a place where there has to be a lot of transparency and follow up, particularly by journalists, to make sure that, you know, massive conglomerates aren't getting these contracts because they're politically favored, or make sure they're paying prevailing wages, et cetera.
Sure, sure. Well, who controls that? I mean, is that like the governor in a particular state has a fund that's overseen by some state agency at the federal level? Is it the General Accountability Office?
Well, it depends. Actually, I mean, part of the thing is that the actual money, the funding streams are incredibly complicated and diverse. I mean, some of them are funding streams expanding what are already existing programs. Some of those existing programs are federal programs in which contracting procurement is overseen by the federal agency that is tasked with running that program. Some of them are state-federal partnerships in which money is passed through to the state, and essentially the state decides how the money gets spent. And some of them are new programs. So there's going to be a new bureaucratic edifice that's going to have to be erected
right.
to make sure that the money goes in the right place.
Well, that could be troublesome. Let's talk about the broadband issue. It sounded like you were really crowing about the idea of broadband infrastructure. How much would broadband upgrades throughout the country and a kind of a Koreanization of mm-hmm. America in some sense to create the broadband like exists in places in East Asia be like rural electrification in the 1930s, where the idea of electricity in certain rural areas was thought as kind of superfluous but became a real cultural binding force for the United States?
Yeah, I mean, you sort of took the analogy right out of my mouth. I think it would be tremendously important. It's really remarkable.
I guess I am trying to be Mr. Smarty here, and I should just shut up. All right, go ahead, Chris.
No, I think you're exactly right. I mean, I think it would be tremendously good for the American economy, and particularly for areas that have seen, particularly areas that are rural, and also areas that have been rapidly deindustrialized, in which, you know, people, I think your listeners listening right now in large metro and urban areas perhaps don't quite realize how sparse broadband access is in large swaths of particularly rural areas in America. And, you know, essentially at this point it is become sort of just a threshold feature of being part of the kind of modern economy.
Right. Let's shift to politics. I deliberately began with the nuts and bolts, even as little as we know about them, because this is only the House bill. But the Republicans have made a deliberate decision that their fingerprints aren't on this at all. Are they taking a risk here?
Yeah, it's essentially an all-in bet, and I don't necessarily think it's – I think it was kind of the only play they had politically. I mean, look, if you're the Republicans, if things get better and the stimulus is to have thought to work, to whatever sense that is, you're not going to get a ton of credit as a group for voting for it. I mean, it's still going to be Barack Obama's bill. It's still going to be a Democratic Congress. What your only hope is that it fails, and you could then say, I told you so. And so,
but there's something so disheartening about that. I mean, from my perspective as a person in the media, I'm wondering if the ubiquity of the media now, unlike what was the case during the 1930s, demands that there be an opposition that is diametrically opposed to what the prevailing authorities are doing. And so it raises the profile of people who, back in the FDR days, might have sort of gone along and been part of some urgent national movement to deal with a crisis.
That might be true. I think part of it also is just the fact that there's been two things. One is that, you know, when FDR was passing things in the very, very beginning of his administration, what would be, you know, essentially correlated to the time period we're in now, the crisis in the country was far more acute. I mean, it was much more like that week after Lehman failed that he was operating in which we saw, you know, the 83 senators voting for the TARP. So
right.
He had a much, there was more an acute sense of panic. I mean, he had to declare a bank holiday, there were bank runs, et cetera, et cetera. Second of all, I think there has been an interesting shift in the culture of Capitol Hill during the Bush years into what sort of resembles a kind of quasi-parliamentary system in which legislators see in the minority, particularly the Republicans, have really kind of coalesced around this notion of party unity and party line votes, and kind of marshal their power. They try to leverage it as a block, as a party, in a way that's actually fairly unique and distinct in the history of American legislative politics. And the interesting question is whether the Democrats figure that out and act accordingly, or they still sort of comport themselves under the old rules.
And, of course, the Senate behaves very, very differently. And, we're going to see a lot more, you know, we're going to see different kinds of arguments and a lot more cooperation. What do you expect, first of all, in terms of the nature of the debate and then the kinds of things that are going to be in the Senate bill that are going to have to be reconciled later?
Well, it's going to be a totally different debate. I mean, because you know you're going to have a sort of batch of Republican senators who might actually vote for the bill, and that's going to create a totally different set of terms around what the negotiating principles are. With the House Republicans, it was always fairly clear that A, it was going to pass whether they liked it or not, and B, they probably weren't going to vote for it. In the Senate, it's a whole different story. I think in the Senate, you're going to see much less these sort of ideological shibboleths that you saw from the House Republicans and more kind of narrow geographic and regional concerns. So I think you're going to see the senators, the Republican senators, say Susan Collins and Olympia Snow from Maine, possibly Voinovich from Ohio, who kind of push more sort of narrower regional interests into the stimulus in trying to make sure they kind of get theirs in
right.
It rather than this kind of ideological war against government spending.
Well, Chris Hayes, before we go, and there's so much to talk about on this, I just wanted to ask you, something we're asking our listeners this morning, and that is, you know, have you seen a giant sale in your neighborhood? Have you gotten anything for 70% off? Have you?
You know, I bought a suit really cheap recently.
How cheap?
It was about I don't know. I was marked down around 60%, somewhere in the neighborhood of that.
So it was a $100 suit?
Yeah, it was around $150. Yeah.
And what's your normal? What do you normally pay?
Oh God, normal. I don't own that many suits. So
quickly.
You know, somewhere around $300.
All right. Chris Hayes, finding deals in Washington, D.C. as editor of The Nation. Thanks, Chris.
Thanks, John.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. Amidst all the shuttered storefronts and other signs of economic hard times, prices are coming down, and we want to know how you're experiencing that. What big deals are you getting in your town? Are you seeing cheaper tickets to sporting events, discounts on electronics, that sorts of thing? We are looking for the best deal you've seen in your local community because of bad economic times. And if you got something for 70 or 80% off, did it make you feel like you've been ripped off most of the time? Are lower prices actually making you buy? We want your stories at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Now we want to talk about, you know, human beings. And human beings could not survive alone on this planet. We have to have special relationships with all kinds of creatures to survive. Not just horses, not just birds, not just dogs and cats. No, no, no. All kinds of creatures.
When the worm approaches, you must be utterly still and close enough to plant the hook firmly under a ring segment. The worm will turn to lift this exposed area as far from the abrasive sand as possible, and it will take you with it to the top. Wait till the head of the worm passes, then go quickly.
In the great Frank Herbert book, Dune, you could ride worms on that planet. But Joel Weinstock, who joins us now, he's the chief of the Division of Gastroenterology and Hepatology at Tufts University. Joel reports that actually a much more profound relationship between humans and worms actually can lead to the cure or prevention of disease. Joel, we need worms. Is that true?
Well, this is an area of active investigation that is currently underway. There is some data suggesting that natural exposure to worms is beneficial for people.
Now, there's all kinds of symbiotic, I don't know if that's exactly the right word, but close relationships between humans and creatures, particularly E. coli in the digestive system, or the relationship with a bacterium, right?
Well, yes, and in our GI tract, there are literally billions of bacteria, and about half the dry weight of our stool is living organisms, though people don't realize that. And these living organisms are important for us, for both our nutrition, toning our immune system, and keeping us well. If we sterilized our bodies and eliminated our exposure to the organisms that live within us, we would die.
So how did you discover the particular importance for a particular group of people of having worms inside the body?
Well, worms are animals. They're not bacteria,
right,
or viruses. Excuse me. And they have been within the GI tract of people, dogs, cats, all animals, for the millennia, thousands and thousands of years. In the 20th century, we started deworming the population so that people did not have worms in their GI tract.
So deworming is a relatively recent phenomenon in human history.
That is correct. Up until the 20th century, everyone's always had them. The worms have lived closely with us. We have lived closely with the worms. And it appears that we've become dependent on each other. And it is possible that the process of deworming, eliminating all worms from the GI tract, could be leading to a very rapid rise in certain types of immunological diseases.
Let's talk about multiple sclerosis for a moment, because that's not an obvious one that I would have expected a worm relationship to help. Tell me about that research.
Well, there's certain diseases such as multiple sclerosis, inflammatory bowel disease, type 1 diabetes, asthma, allergic rhinitis, hay fever, are diseases that emerged in the 20th century. So up to the 20th century, these conditions were very, very rare.
Oh, that's fascinating.
And now they're very common. And so when you see diseases like that all shifting together, you start wondering what are the environmental factors that are causing these diseases to emerge, because it obviously isn't genetics, because our genes don't mutate that quickly. So that implied they're either environmental factors that cause these diseases or the lack of exposures to things in the environment lead to these diseases.
And so what you discovered in observing people with actual whipworm infections in Argentina had milder cases of multiple sclerosis. Why would that be the case?
Well, worms induce within the body certain types of cells that regulate the immune system, so that when you're attacked by a virus, when you're attacked by bad bacteria, not the good ones, your immune system has to gear up and become very violent to be able to kill away those viruses and bacteria so you remain healthy. But the immune system also has another side, known as the regulatory side of the immune system. And this side of the immune system tones down and modulates those responses so they're not destructive.
Huh.
So what we think is actually happening is that lack of exposures to worms and perhaps other organisms is leading to very poor development of the regulatory aspects of our immune system, allowing these diseases to emerge.
So the immune system is used to having help from worms, and without it responds more aggressively and maybe causes problems that didn't exist centuries earlier. Joel, we have to go, but I'd love to talk about this more. I guess my last question to you would be, are we likely to see from doctors such as yourself a call for the reworming of the human population, and that becomes as controversial as, say, fluoridation in the 50s?
Well, there is already worm-based medications that have been developed. They're under testing right now, both in the United States and in Europe, as treatments for people with immunological diseases. So this is not as far away as you may think.
Well, Joel, thank you very much. I'm going to have a nice bowl of worms this morning for breakfast based on your advice. Dr. Joel Weinstock is the chief of the Division of Gastroenterology and Hepatology at Tufts University Medical Center. Worms. Worms for peace. Worms for health. What do you think of that, Femi?
I've eaten worms, actually. They're very tasty. Mealyworms for a protein experiment.
Uh-huh.
It worked. We had to bake them. But that's another story for another day.
Any other headlines besides eating worms?
28 minutes past the hour, I do. Kodak announced this morning that it's eliminating at least 3,500 jobs. That's 14% of its payroll. The company says that sales of both digital and film products have plummeted. And that comes on top of Starbucks' announcement yesterday that it will cut 6,700 jobs and close more than 300 stores. Now, in just a few minutes, we'll find out how many people applied for unemployment last week. Expectations say that they're expecting 575,000 new claims, and that's down a little bit from the week before, but we'll find out for real in the next few moments or so. The House passed the economic stimulus package yesterday, but not with flying colours. The measure went through without any Republican votes. And that's a look at some of the stories making news.
Oh, no, I love your last story there. Afghanistan is delaying its presidential elections until August. That's a sign of inner turmoil
because
in
security,
Afghanistan.
Because of security, lack of security.
Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of home, auto, and life insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. We were talking around the office all morning. I've seen 80% off. I've seen 70% off. What have you seen? Things are coming down in price, and the sale numbers are extraordinary. We want you to give us some advice about where the good deals are all over America.
Hey, good morning. My name's Dave from Chicago. I don't know about 70% off or anything like that, but I got a family of four, and we're going to be heading down to Disney World in April. They got this deal, 7 nights for the price of 4. And let me tell you, we're getting hotel, airfare, their meal plan, their service to and from the airport, tickets to the park. We're getting all that for under $3,000. If you go for 5 days, it'll cost you more than the one I'm paying for a family of four to go down there for a whole entire week.
Nice. There's a deal in Chicago for Disney World. What's the best deal you've seen? Tell us your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Speaking of good deals, Jeff Beresford Howe, Takeaway Tailgater, joins us from L.A. Jeff, you've got a deal to share, eh?
I'm going to go see the Los Angeles Kings tonight of the NHL in the 8th row for $11.50.
$11.50 to sit on the blue line and watch
yep.
the Kings?
That's right. The people sitting next to me will have paid $140 for their seats.
Who do you know, Jeff?
I know the number for Ticketmaster. In December, Los Angeles Kings put all their January tickets on sale for $11.50. They got 15,000 responses and have been playing the whole month of January in front of packed houses.
So is this something that the Kings have stumbled onto? Hey, lower our prices, get more people. Or is this a real big economic trend?
Well, the Kings stumble a lot, but yeah, this is out in California in particular, this is a huge economic trend. A lot of the teams out here are doing that. The Los Angeles Clippers, the Golden State Warriors, the Sacramento Kings, a lot of teams are deeply discounting tickets right now.
You know, the inflation of tickets in sports has been an interesting kind of cultural story from my perspective, and I wonder if you could help me out with this because you follow it much more closely than I do. It seemed to me that in the Michael Jordan era, you know, 3,000 years ago, the NBA was the hottest sports ticket. The NFL has always had high ticket prices because there's a supply issue. There's only, you know, 16 games per season. But I'm right. wondering if the sports have over time separated and that there's a high price sport, medium price sport, and a low price sport, and if that's really shifting now.
Well, the NHL and the NBA have always unaccountably had extremely high ticket prices. They are the first sports that are really seeing the effects of the economic slowdown, I think. I mean, we'll see it over the summer in baseball. Baseball does usually have the most low-priced tickets because they play so many games. But you're really seeing the effects in basketball and hockey right now. The Golden State Warriors just announced a two-for-one deal. Buy two tickets, or buy one ticket, get another one free. And one of the games they're doing that is against the San Antonio Spurs, who are NBA royalty. It's an extraordinary thing.
So it doesn't really matter if LeBron James is coming. The ticket prices are coming down, no matter who's playing.
Unless, of course, you're in New York, where the entire city seems to be completely unaffected by this trend. You'd never know it was happening if you lived in New York.
Yeah, tell me about it. What do season ticket holders see from this kind of effect? I mean, they've already paid their prices.
Well, the Los Angeles Kings have apparently gotten quite a lot of pushback from their fans about people who are not happy about having paid more than 10 times what the guy next to him paid. And they're what they say they're doing is trying to make it up with season ticket, quote, enhancements, which is, I guess, mostly like locking the players in the room with the fans and saying, here, talk to each other. But teams are concerned that it might be a long-term problem, that by adopting a more airline-like pricing model, you're going to see more inequities that way and more upset long-term fans.
So you're a season ticket holder, right?
Yep.
And have you had, you know, the team call you and say, hey, Jeff, how you feeling? You know, can we help you out in any way?
I had a hassle over my tickets, which I've had for years. And I told one guy on the phone, look, I'm going to jump to the San Francisco Giants. I'm an Oakland A's ticket holder. And within a day, three different people in the organization have called me back or emailed me and said, hey, we're really sorry. We're going to make this right. Let's get it done. And, you know, my total expenditure is $660 a year. I'm not a cash cow. It was an extraordinary response, and the A's are famous for not being good at customer service.
That's a pretty huge sort of sign of the times.
It is, and, you know, both the Clippers and the L.A. Kings have hired people to call fans who purchased tickets on Ticketmaster and asked them the week of the game, you know, hey, is everything going good? Are you ready for the game? Is there anything else we can do to help? I mean,
Are they from India, the people that call?
No, they are not.
Really? Wow. That's interesting. There's a movie possibility. All right, well, before we go, Super Bowl tickets aren't going to suddenly be, two-tier priced between now and the weekend.
No, probably not, huh?
Probably not. But is the NFL likely to, feel some of this? Because they are the real sort of peak of the mountain here.
Well, I private jet travel to the Super Bowl is way down, if that means anything. Next year, it'll be interesting to see how the cash cow of the NFL, which is luxury boxes, sell around the league. And I think it's way too early to tell for that.
And how many touchdowns are the Cardinals going to win by, Jeff?
7 points. Cardinals are going to win because they are the most 80s 49ers-like team out there.
You really are picking the Cardinals?
Damn right.
Man, watch your language there, Jeff Beresford Howard. Talking like a tailgater out there, but that's what we expect. Jeff Beresford Howard, our sports guy, tailgater from Los Angeles, California. And now with the headlines on anything except sports, although I haven't looked at your script yet. Femi Oke is here with the headlines.
Hello there, John. The time is just coming up to 21 minutes to the top of the hour. We have some new economic indicators just in. The number of people who applied for unemployment rose slightly last week. The total number applying hit an all-time record of 4.8 million. And meanwhile, durable goods orders tumbled for the fifth straight month.
And neither of those were expected, I don't think.
No, exactly. President Obama will sign into law the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act. The measure gives workers more time to sue their employers for past discrimination. It ends a 2007 Supreme Court decision that said workers only had 180 days to file a pay discrimination lawsuit. Afghanistan is delaying its presidential elections until August. The vote was originally planned for the spring, but election commissioners say that they need more time to beef up security. Shukriya Braxai is a member of Afghanistan's National Assembly.
There's lots of optimism, but at the meantime, there are lots of challenges for the new election would be. Condition is getting more worse, security is bad, and the lack of stability still is there.
And Raxai believes that the election could be further postponed if security doesn't improve. The incumbent president, Hamid Karzai, will face several challenges, but he appears on track to win re-election. And a new study says that chemicals commonly found in upholstery and carpets could damage a woman's fertility. It's published today in the journal Human Reproduction, and researchers studied over 1,200 women, and they found that infertility was linked with higher concentrations of the chemicals, or PFCs, in the bloodstream. And PFCs are used in products from food packaging to shampoo.
That's alarming. Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Adore Udoji is away. Back to stimulus now, okay, as we've talked about all hour long, really. $30 billion as part of the $819 billion bill that the House passed last night is going to go to highway construction. That's one of the largest investments in history in that kind of infrastructure. And it means we're going to need gravel, we're going to need line paint, and we're going to need asphalt. Lots and lots of asphalt. And Jay Hansen, Vice President of Government Affairs for the National Asphalt Pavement Association, I gather it's pretty darn convenient that there's an asphalt processing plant in every congressional district in the United States, right?
That's right, John. There's about 3,500 asphalt plants in the country. And I would say right now we're probably 50% underutilized in the capacity. So once this legislation gets enacted, we're ready to go.
So you're beyond shovel-ready. I mean, you got the tars cooking at this point.
Well, just say that at the plants, there's aggregate, there's liquid asphalt in the tanks, and all we need to do is rehire the workers that have been laid off, and we're ready to go, as I said.
How many workers would that be, by your estimate?
Well, the industry employs about 300,000 people, both directly and indirectly, and our unemployment numbers are some of the highest in the country at about 12 to 15% right now.
So, you know, what I've been trying to do with every aspect of this stimulus bill is to try, as we look at, you know, projects that are on the books now that they want to fund, you know, what component of the project is just sort of switching on machines? What component of the project is buying products that are going to result in new manufacturing jobs or returned manufacturing jobs? And what kinds of jobs are going to be, you know, contracting jobs that result from this? Can you break it down for me at all?
Well, a little bit. Once this legislation is passed, you know, a lot of states have already gone through their project lists, and they know what projects they want to get going. In fact, they've submitted lists up to the state, up to the Congress. But once the legislation is enacted, the first wave of projects will probably be those maintenance and rehabilitation projects that are, frankly, perfect for asphalt. We'll get out there. We'll mill the top 2 inches off the road. Put another layer of asphalt down, and for the traveling public, they'll see a nice smooth road at the end of it. So when you're looking at those kind of projects, you're looking at the paving crews, the people in the trucks that are hauling the material back and forth from the plant to the job site. You have the people at the plant, the technicians, the lab workers, and so forth. But as the time marches on, some of these bigger projects will get in full swing, and then you're looking at you know, people buying equipment,
right,
other types of material, steel and so forth.
And that those are big follow-ons, right?
Yes.
So are you happy about this bill and what's going on?
Well, sure, we're happy about the bill, but our markets have been so down, both in, well, publicly funded highways has been down the last 2 years. And then, of course, commercial and residential have been down. And frankly, John, you know, states are letting contracts contingent on the stimulus bill being enacted. So, yes, it's additional funding, but it's not nearly enough to bring us up to where we were just 2 years ago.
Well, he's smelling the aroma of tar, but still a little bit on pins and needles there. Jay Hansen, a lobbyist and vice president for government affairs for the National Asphalt Pavement Association, which stands to benefit from this stimulus bill. Thanks, Jay.
Thank you, John.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, and we're going to begin with headlines from Femi Oke once again.
And the time is 13 minutes to the top of the hour. Private military contractor Blackwater is out of business in Iraq. Today, Iraq says it will no longer allow the company to operate there. That's a potential challenge to U.S. officials. The American government pays Blackwater to protect many diplomats in Iraq, and Iraq says that it is kicking out Blackwater for excessive force. And the highest profile controversy for the company came with its involvement in a 2007 shooting where 17 Iraqi civilians died. President Obama's stimulus bill is halfway to becoming law, but without any Republican support. It's passed the House without even a one Republican vote. The lack of GOP support came in the face of an aggressive White House lobbying campaign. A few Democrats also voted against the bill. The stimulus plan now moves to the Senate. Attorney General nominee Eric Holder could be sworn in and confirmed as early as today. Yesterday, the Senate Judiciary Committee cleared him for a vote in the full Senate. And former Admiral Dennis Blair is now confirmed as Director of National Intelligence, and the Senate approved him yesterday. And more than 1 million people are stuck in the cold and dark without power. The Midwest ice storm has knocked out power in several states, and power officials say that some homes will be stuck that way for weeks. And more than 20 people have died as the storm barreled through the Midwest and the Northeast. That's a look at your news for now, John.
And weekly unemployment job numbers hit another record, and Wall Street looks to open lower in about 40 minutes. Thank you, Femi. So we are reporting all morning long about George Mitchell, who's the Middle East envoy in the Middle East, trying to settle that conflict or at least make inroads now that the Obama administration is underway. We're looking for some insight into what it's like to sit down at the table with George Mitchell as an actual mediator. He is, of course, Barack Obama's Middle East envoy. And joining us now, who has some insight, is Gerry Adams, president of the Irish and Northern Irish political party Sinn Féin. Adams was in the middle of it when George Mitchell negotiated the Good Friday Accords, which ended the conflict in Northern Ireland, or at least put down the weapons. Gerry Adams, what is it like to sit across the table from George Mitchell, get parties that aren't really inclined to talk to one another to actually make peace and find some common ground?
No, George, as you probably know, had a judicial career in the USA. He also was in the Senate for a very, very long time. He is very quietly spoken, good-humored, very decent, and hugely patient. And I think he brought all of those qualities to our process before he became the chair of the talks, which led to the Good Friday Agreement, of course. He had been appointed by President Clinton to act as an envoy. He had been chair of what was a decommissioning body, which then came up with principles, which allowed people to sign up to nonviolence. That was everybody who was involved, governments as well as others. So when it actually came to the Good Friday Agreement negotiations, he had been around the process for some time. He also, when he arrived in to chair those meetings, was barred from entering the room by the unionist, and in fact had to sit in his own room for 2 days.
No kidding.
So you can see, you know, that he is well equipped in his own right, in his own political career in the USA, and his career on the bench, but by dint of his personality, to come at these issues with considerable ability. Now,
well, Gerry Adams, so it sounds like from what you're saying that at the very least, Hamas is not going to phase George Mitchell if he, you know, was able to have the patience to deal with the unionists.
Well, I don't want to compare the two, but a lot of the success or failure of any process in the Middle East will depend in the first instance on the people who live there. I mean, George Mitchell, and he's a friend of mine, and I'm very proud to have known him. I continue in contact with him occasionally. But he didn't make peace in Ireland. He would tell you that himself.
Right.
The people who made peace are the people who live here.
Well, let's talk strategy and tactics in the actual negotiations. Is George Mitchell the kind of person that drives to the hard issues immediately or picks apart the problem in a way that it can be easily or more easily handled by the parties?
Well, two responses to that question. In the first instance, it depends on his brief. At one point in the course of our discussions here, I said to him, you know, Senator, this is about getting justice. This is about getting a totally different dispensation. And I went on in this vein for some time. And then he said to me, well, that isn't my brief. So it depends on the brief that he has. Now, as it has turned out, because of measures and protocols that we have put in place as part of the Good Friday Agreement, there is increasing equality, there is increasing justice. But I just make that point, you know, George can only fulfill whatever brief he is given. Secondly, it needs the very, very active support of the international community. There is no onus on the Israeli government, or indeed one could argue for people in leadership on the Palestinian side, to actually make peace unless there is an incentive for them to do it. So there is a process in the Middle East without peace. It's been an ongoing process now.
So you remind us that the process has to be viable and that the goal of Barack Obama has to be aggressive enough that George Mitchell has something to offer.
Yes, and you know, then the rest of it, you know, I mean, and George is a good listener. He was dealing with the unionists. The unionists went through the Good Friday Agreement without talking directly to Sinn Féin. They went through that entire process.
Right.
And, you know, bear in mind, the Good Friday Agreement is at least 10 years old now. And there are still quibbles over elements of it. It would have been a much better agreement if the unions had talked to us. They now talk to us, which obviously is a good thing. But it is possible to get an agreement, but the agreement will only stick by dint of the political will of those who are participating. And I'll say this very clearly. I think it might be a cliche by now. It's easy to make peace with your friends. It's making peace with your enemies, which is the challenge.
And and I think that's said often talking about the Middle East. Before we go, when you saw George Mitchell there in Union Station as you were on your way to the seas of people in the inauguration, what did you say to him?
Well, we actually joked. It was in my head to ask him about the Middle East because there had been some press speculation. I sort of came up behind him and shoved against him. He was on the phone. He was trying to organize a lift. And his family was with him. So we just joked. We just joked at the amazing coincidence that we would bump into each other on such a day. But let me make a last point, if I may.
Sure.
What the U.S. government does on the issue of the Middle East will be absolutely pivotal to there being a peace settlement. And Sinn Féin's position, because we're not against Israel, we understand a lot of what happens, but we are against the killings, whoever carries them out, and the security, the actual security of Israel is totally linked to the security of the Palestinian territories. The two regions, the two states, and the future security and prosperity and harmony between the people of those two states is absolutely linked.
And that's something that Israelis and Palestinians have reiterated to us. The question is, will that be the goal and the sort of mantra in the talks that George Mitchell oversees in the Middle East? Jerry Adams, I can't tell you how happy we are that you were able to join us this morning.
Okay, John, and good luck, and good luck to George Mitchell and to the people of Palestine and the people of Israel.
Sharing his familiarity about George Mitchell, now a Middle East envoy, is Jerry Adams, president of the Irish and Northern Irish political party Sinn Féin. One upside of tough economic times is that we hear some big ticket items are coming down in price. Certainly the manufacturing of those items is coming down by 3.9%, figures just out. But we want you to give us some advice about where the good deals are on all kinds of items. What are you seeing in your town? 877-8-MY-TAKE. Or mytake@thetakeaway.org. And your takeaway this hour comes from inside the Beltway.
You're not going to get a ton of credit as a group for voting for it. I mean, it's still going to be Barack Obama's bill. It's still going to be a Democratic Congress. What your only hope is that it fails, and you could then say, I told you so.
Placing blame or getting credit, that's the dilemma for a congressman in Washington. And that's Chris Hayes, Washington, D.C. editor of The Nation, talking about the stimulus bill that passed last night without a single Republican voting for it. Chris Hayes calls it an all-in bet. What's the risk there? Well, if you want to go back and listen to Chris Hayes' interview, we're always on. Take our podcast to go. Subscribe now at thetakeaway.org or on iTunes. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
And they're off.
The bill is passed. Without objection, a motion to reconsider is laid upon the table.
Yes, your Obama stimulus is on its way to a ready shovel or an empty wallet or a hungry government program near you. Next stop, the Senate. Who gets what? Who votes how? Who takes goodies home to his or her district? The economy gets a shot. This won't hurt a bit on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Thursday, January 29th. Adoree Udoji is away. Some economic ghost stories this morning to try to predict what's ahead in this economy. We need an engine after the stimulus package passed. A conversation with someone who's looking for some of those ghosts. The underdog Arizona Cardinals are in the Super Bowl this weekend. So, you say? Well, there's a lot more to the story. It's a surprising trip for a team of oddballs. But the headlines first. An array of key economic data is just out the last hour. No good news there, unfortunately. New jobless claims are up. And some 4.8 million people are continuing to collect unemployment checks. And those checks will probably continue for a longer time based on this stimulus bill that's just passed. That's the highest ever since they started tracking in the 60s in raw numbers. Also just out, durable goods orders. These are the big ticket items factories make, and they're a key economic indicator. That number tumbled for the fifth straight month. Last year was the worst since the 2001 recession. All of these numbers are worse than analysts predicted, and it's having an effect on Wall Street's open, expected to be down in the open in about a half hour. The White House can certainly claim a win this morning on that stimulus package, but they're not too crazy about the score. President Obama's plan has passed the House, but without a single Republican vote. Democrats say they can have the bill passed and on the president's desk by mid-February, but so much for bipartisanship. Femi Okeh is here with some more headlines.
Thanks, John. The Illinois State Senate is all but guaranteed to be more fun than Washington today. Governor Rod Blagojevich will make his first appearance at his own impeachment trial there. And it's been going on all week, but Blagojevich has skipped it in favor of some numerous TV interviews. He says the trial is unfair.
The View is fair.
Depends if the ladies like you or not. I think they might like you, John.
Maybe. I've never
I'll
been
suggest
asked
you for
to go
next
on the show.
Guess.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Scott Hockenberry.
You
yeah.
made me lose my thread. Okay, so Blagojevich says that his impeachment trial is unfair, but he will still make a closing argument today, and he gets 90 minutes to speak but won't answer questions or take an oath. U.S. Special Envoy George Mitchell meets with West Bank Palestinians today, and this after a talk with Israeli leaders yesterday. And inside Gaza, aid workers say that they're having trouble doing their jobs. Here's Dr. Ishmael Meir.
Most of the medical care that we've been providing, we've been improvising on how to do things. Not the best way to do it. I mean, totally the whole medical system is on the verge of collapse due to this embargo.
And Dr. Meir is one of a group of doctors from the U.S. giving care in Gaza.
A recap of Wall Street expected to open lower. The S&P starts at 875. So where are the deals in your community? We're asking everyone if you're seeing these prices plummet.
You know, I bought a suit really cheap. It was about, I don't know. It was marked down around 60%, somewhere in there, somewhere in the neighborhood of that.
It's our friend Chris Hayes, Washington, D.C., editor of The Nation, who's getting great deals on flashy suits. Join the conversation, 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adoree Udoji.
Good morning, everybody. Well, Dr. Hockenberry is here. Roll up your sleeve or drop your drawers. Which is it? The economy is about to get an $819 billion shot in the whatever. Well, depending on whether you're a Republican or Democrat, you've rolled up your sleeve or you feel like you're dropping your drawers. Who gets what in this stimulus bill that passed the House and is on its way to the Senate? Who's really expecting something to go to their district? That's three slices of a very important piece of legislation that now we're going to handle all three slices with three guests right here in this segment. Nate Silver joins us. He's the founder of 538.com from Chicago. Nate, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, good morning.
Greg Ipp is the U.S. economics editor of The Economist. He joins us from Washington. Greg, thanks for being here.
Good morning.
And Congressman Vernon Ehlers of Michigan's 3rd Congressional District, including Grand Rapids, where I went to high school. Congressman, thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
First, Nate, let's begin with you. Who voted for? Who voted against? How does the politics break down on this bill? Looks pretty grim for bipartisanship this morning.
Yeah, I mean, on the Republican side, it's pretty deep to analyze where you had every single vote being against it. I mean, I think this was a surprise. I know people expected not very many votes, maybe a dozen or so, but to have, you know, unanimity was surprising. On the Democratic side, you had You know, 12 votes against it, mostly Blue Dogs, a few kind of freshman congressmen. And these votes you might expect to be against the bill for the most part, mostly from the South.
How much of a risk do you think these legislators are taking by sort of going all in and stepping away from this bill?
Well, I mean, we might see different behavior from the Senate Republicans, I think. But I think there is a risk, especially in every single vote being against it, where Obama had met with the leadership, I think, two or three times, and that's kind of a big story. I mean, the headlines aren't terribly good, where the headlines kind of say, well, Obama was trying to be kind of the adult in the room, so to speak, and the Republicans kind of show them the back of their hand. I think I understand the vote against it, but I think to have some votes would, instead of, you know, unanimous opposition, might have looked a little bit better as far as the optics of everything go.
Well, the optics and the politics. Nate Silver, thanks for joining us, the founder of 538.com. There's the political rundown on this bill, a game of chicken, it would appear, between the Democrats and the Republicans. Who's going to blink? Will the bill change on its way to the Senate, or will Republicans get on board? That remains to be seen. But Greg Ipp, U.S. economics editor of The Economist, who gets what in this bill? What's the proportionality of tax cuts and actual spending on projects?
On the basic surface, it looks like a little over half is for spending, a little under half for tax cuts. That's not quite exactly how it works out, because some of the tax cuts are actually tax credits. In other words, they're refundable amounts of money that will go to people who actually wouldn't have earned enough to have paid taxes that year. And the way it works in Congress, they can call those tax cuts, but they're actually a payment. And when you add that in, most of it's towards spending, and the biggest chunk of that is the so-called Making Work Pay Credit, about $145 billion over 2 years, which is essentially designed to be an offset for the payroll tax that a lot of workers pay towards Medicare and Social Security. And that will have one of the fastest and most immediate impacts on economic growth.
Making Work Pay Program, how does that work? If I'm looking at my paycheck or my W-2 form, what's that going to do for me?
Essentially, what happens is that if you, round numbers, earn less than $200,000, then a single worker would be eligible up to a $500 a year tax credit, and a couple up to $1,000 a year towards the payroll tax that you pay towards your Social Security and Medicare. It'll phase out for higher income workers. It's designed to assist people who are lower on the income scale and more likely to spend the money. And it'll take effect by a reduction in the withholding on your paycheck.
A lot of Republicans were making a considerable amount of noise about money going to government programs which can't possibly work, won't stimulate the economy. What government programs are going to benefit, and what would be the stimulative argument that these particular programs are going to have?
Probably the most important, the one that I think concerns Republicans the most, is the expansion in the federal share of Medicaid funding. That will be about $87 billion over 2 years. Medicaid is a shared program by the states and the federal government, but because many states are very strapped for money right now, they're forced to reduce their expenditures on Medicaid, and which would bring about a reduction in the federal portion as well, all else equal.
So even though it's a Medicaid bill, it's actually a revenue-sharing provision that bails out the states.
It does, and it will have some help in the sense that the states, in order to have maintained their Medicare spending, might have had to cut something else, for example, road maintenance or teachers, and that will make it less urgent to do so. So it will have that stimulative impact. But there's no question it's not the traditional stimulus in the sense of bricks and mortar that we usually think about in terms of government assistance to boosting economic growth.
Well, Greg Ipp, thanks for helping us to see the proportionality there. He's the U.S. economics editor of The Economist. He joined us from Washington. Thanks, Greg. And now, sure. Congressman Vernon Ehlers of Michigan's 3rd District, what are you telling your constituents this morning about what the House passed?
Well, obviously, the bill was not something that the Republicans felt they could vote for. Part of the difficulty was we were anxious to vote for a good bill. We were anxious to work on the good bill. And the Democrats are flush with power now after gaining more seats in the last election, and saw no need to accommodate us or talk to us or compromise with us in any way.
All right. Well, two questions. What's the accommodation? What couple of lines, many lines, many pages in the bill would change to get your vote?
Well, part of it is the immensity of it. When it started out, we were very much in favor of it. We thought virtually all the money was going to go, was essentially aimed at trying to get out of the recession, trying to get people back to work, and so forth. And when you analyze this, we're spending immense amount of money for many things that are not in that category. The money spent is equivalent to roughly $200,000 for every job created, and that's not a particularly good price for job creation. But in addition to that, it turned into a wish list for the Democrats. All their favorite projects that they wanted to fund for a long time, they threw money into the pot for that too.
What about your district? Isn't there a chance that I-131 is going to US-131 would get repaved, or they might straighten out some of the curves there in downtown Grand Rapids that caused so many safety problems on the roads?
Actually, the curve has been straightened out a few years ago.
Yeah, I got to come back and visit my relatives, don't I?
Yes, you should. But at any rate, when you look at the road construction, we thought there'd be quite a bit of that. There's just not that much money in there, in the neighborhood of $60, $70 billion for construction projects of various sorts. And a lot of money went to other things that that were not related to creating jobs. And that's I was surprised that the Republicans were unanimous in rejecting it. I knew there was strong feeling against the process and the content of the bill. But I expected some Republicans would vote for it. I was also surprised that there were a reasonable number of Democrats who voted against it. So clearly, it's a work in progress. We are waiting to see what the Senate does on it. I think they will probably come up with a much more reasonable bill. And so we will get a second crack at it. It's not that this is the first and only bill. This is the beginning salvo, and we expressed our opposition to it.
What do you make of the argument that Nate Silver made right a few minutes ago, suggesting that the way Barack Obama is acting here is sort of reaching a hand across the aisle, looks, in his words, like the adult in the room, and that the Republicans sort of standing back and saying, I'm not going to vote for this, maybe looks a little less than adult? What was your reaction to that?
Well, I don't think that's a proper analysis. First of all, he hasn't really reached out other than coming to meet with us, in which he answered questions, but it was not a work session, not an attempt to come up with a compromise or something that we could agree on. He's basically saying, this is a good bill, I want you to vote for it. And as you know, in politics, that doesn't work. You have to take into account the views of the people. But the cost of it was really what bothered a lot of the Republicans. For example, the total cost comes to something like $2,700 for every man, woman, and child in the United States. And spending $200,000 for every job created is... it seems a bit excessive.
Well, Congressman, before we go, Bill Clinton, when he was having such a difficulty with Congress, his approach was basically to adopt the program of the Republicans and essentially make it his. Couldn't that be your strategy here, to basically say, yeah, this was all our idea, we're voting for it?
No, because it wasn't our idea. It was pretty clear it wasn't our idea.
Well, it wasn't Clinton's idea either, so.
Yeah, but it's basically all just... They put together a huge wish list, and that's what came out of the Appropriations Committee. That's what came to the floor. And it was just no serious attempt at all at including the Republicans, negotiating with Republicans on it. And I think their attitude is they're just going to ram this through the way they want it, show their folks back home that they did, and then we'll do the serious negotiating after the Senate acts on it.
Congressman Vernon Ehlers of Michigan's 3rd Congressional District looking for a second crack at the stimulus bill. Thanks for joining us, Congressman.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. Let's begin with a question. So, who needs forgiveness? who doesn't need forgiveness? If you're going to try to answer that question, you couldn't do better than to start in the land of Rwanda. On February 10th, a conference starts in that nation, where genocide was so prevalent in the decade of the 90s. A conference start that's all about forgiveness. And if there's a music of forgiveness, maybe it would sound something like this. That's the music of Jean-Paul Samputu, who's going to be addressing the conference. He's a musician and cultural ambassador for Rwanda. He's on his way to the February 10th conference in Rwanda. We joined him as he's making his way towards Heathrow Airport. Jean-Paul Samputu, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you so much.
Good morning. And let's just say that, you know, it's not just a musical matter, this forgiveness with you. In 1994, you came home from the chaos and genocide in Rwanda to discover that your neighbors had murdered your entire family. And for the next 9 years, what happened to you?
Yeah, I was 9 years. I was dealing with anger, bitterness, and desire of revenge. And I was suffering and, addicted, alcoholic addicted, because I could not understand why my best friend, we grew up together, is the one who killed my parents. And I lost my mind. I was healed in 2003 just because I decided to forgive him, you know, by forgiving him, by taking that choice, and I was released from that bondage.
What happened in 2003 that led you to choose the option of forgiveness when bitterness and anger had been with you for so many years?
It's a decision I took because that was the only solution, because I was waiting to die, and I couldn't perform. I couldn't show up on the stage. I was always drunk with, you know, not only drinking and even taking drugs. And I decided to see what I can do. I think I didn't even choose to forgive. I think that was that was the choice, because I didn't know what to do again, and I wanted to release from that prison of hatred and bitterness and anger. And I asked a man who is a spiritual man, who I didn't even ask him. He said, no, you need prayers. And they prayed for me. And I went to many things. I went to find witch doctors. I went, you know, and even if he prayed for me, it didn't help me after that, because I was resisting to forgive. And by taking decision, by choosing to decide to forgive, that helped me, and I was healed totally.
So looking for a fix, I mean, first consumed with anger, then looking for a fix, even going to witch doctors, but it wasn't until you made the decision to actually go back to your neighbor, to your best friend, and explicitly forgive him that you were free. What was that like?
Yeah, I went to what we call gachacha. It's a traditional court. Normally, people go there to accuse who did the genocide. It's a place of justice, a place, traditional court where people talk truth, said this one killed the family. Me, I went there, people were surprised because I didn't go to accuse, I went to forgive. I wanted to be free. And it went well, and I got great peace in my heart. And it didn't end there, because now I'm teaching forgiveness and all the people, and not only in Rwanda, because I know the world need the world. This world we live carries the wounds of unforgiveness. That's why you see these so-called violences and war everywhere. We are facing a culture of revenge. That is why we has decided to teach and to spread this message of forgiveness all over the world.
And that's your message as the conference opens on February 10th. And, of course, there's more violence between Congo and Rwanda, even now, in a war that's gone on for a decade, creating more cycles of violence and bitterness and anger. What happened to your music, Jean-Paul, when you made that decision to forgive?
Yeah, This is a good question because my music changed forever after the Rwandan genocide. And in 2003, I started to sing about peace, love, and reconciliation. And since 2003, it's only the awards I won. And before that, I didn't win any award. I won a core award as a best African traditional in Africa. Then I was invited in America because of that. And then I won the international songwriting competition in Nashville. And, my music, when you think peace, it follows you, and awards follows you, and you when you sing the right thing, it's good because the world need that.
Well, peace and forgiveness are infectious. Not only awards, but the music actually comes back. Jean-Paul Samputu, good luck to you.
Thank you.
A man with a lot of forgiveness, Jean-Paul Samputu, Rwandan singer and musician, on his way to a forgiveness conference in Rwanda. And now with the headlines, Femi Oke is here.
Thank you very much, John. The time is just coming up to 28 minutes past the hour. The number of people on unemployment benefits is the highest it's been since the Labour Department began keeping records, and that was more than 40 years ago. Right now, it's at almost 4.8 billion. And the number of new claims from last week rose to 588,000, and that's worse than analysts expected. The House has approved President Obama's economic stimulus package, and the measure, which weighed in at $819 billion, passed without any Republican votes, and that's despite direct appeals to the GOP from the president. Afghanistan is delaying its presidential elections until August. The vote was originally planned for the spring, but election commissioners say that they need more time to beef up security. Shukriya Abraksai is a member of Afghanistan's National Assembly.
There's lots of optimism, but at the meantime, there are lots of challenges for the new election would be. Condition is getting more worse, security is bad, and the lack of stability still is there.
Barakzai believes that the election could be further postponed if security doesn't improve. The CIA's top agent in Algeria is accused of the rape of two Algerian women. The State Department says the women came forward separately with the charges. An investigation is ongoing. The agent has not been charged with any crime yet, and the CIA has removed him from his post. And today, President Obama will sign a law that eliminates a 180-day time limit on suing for equal pay. It's called the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act. That's a look at news making headlines this morning.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of home, auto, and life insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. On a whole variety of economic news reports this morning, the markets are down. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is down more than 1%. Same with the S&P, actually closer to 2% on the S&P. We'll give you more information as we get it throughout this hour, but it's early yet. The markets have only been open for a couple of minutes. One of the best, if you're a buyer of underdogs, look at the Super Bowl this weekend. The Arizona Cardinals facing the Pittsburgh Steelers. It's a buyer's market for underdogs. The Arizona Cardinals are definitely not favored. But joining us to talk about this team and their chances this weekend is New York Times reporter Greg Bishop. He joins us from Tampa, where the Super Bowl will take place on Sunday. The Cardinals are a story. Greg, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Now, the great thing about being an underdog team is that you get enormous amounts of attention the week before the Super Bowl, but then you fade into obscurity if you lose. What's going to be the narrative here for the Cardinals?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, you look at their team this week, and they're short of an open book. So if you go to both press conferences every day, there are a lot more people at the Cardinals one than there might be at the Steelers, because it just haven't been, you know, really, that story hasn't been told before. And then if they lose, you know, on Sunday, it'll just go back to being, you know, Pittsburgh's dominant, and Arizona had a nice run, and they'll kind of fade back into obscurity.
At the center of the Cardinals story is Kurt Warner, who really is making a play for the end zone for his entire career in this game. How important is that to the Cardinals' attention?
Oh, I think absolutely. It's the biggest story of the week. I mean, if you look at Kurt Warner's career, the two Super Bowls he's been in, the one Super Bowl he won, I think it's fair to say that if he wins this game, he's definitely a Hall of Famer. He might be anyway, you know, win or lose. But if he wins this game, I think it's hard to deny his Hall of Fame candidacy.
You know, at the time that he was in his absolute prime and peak, I mean, he was racking up numbers that nobody had seen before. But then, you know, he fell on hard times both on the field and in everywhere else in his life. This has comeback written all over it, and not just in the football record book.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you look at, there was a 5-year stretch when he barely played at all. We saw it in New York. You know, he came in and he backed up Eli Manning and he lost his job. And when he went to Arizona, he went there to be sort of a mentor even to Matt Leinart. And now you see the story. It's almost storybook. I wouldn't be surprised if somebody made a movie out of it one day.
Hmm. Well, you know, the Arizona Cardinals are facing the Pittsburgh Steelers. They've been to the Super Bowl many times. They're one of the premier franchises in the NFL, and they play tough and hard. And is that going to work for this high-flying team that's got receivers and plays the long game?
Yeah, the Steelers are the most physical team in football. They have the best defense. I don't see that defense collapsing against the Cardinals, even though they do have a lot of offensive weapons. I think if you look at the Steelers and their tradition, and you know, they're going for their unprecedented sixth Super Bowl championship, I see that defense and that team and the way they hit is overwhelming Arizona this weekend.
But if in the first quarter Warner can escape that Pittsburgh defense and he's got some time and he's got some room, it's going to be harder for the Steelers to stop the receivers.
No, absolutely. I mean, you look at Arizona with Steve Breaston and Larry Fitzgerald and Anquan Boldin. I mean, they have three guys that gained over 1,000 yards receiving. They've been able to run the ball the last month, which is something they didn't do during the regular season. And if they can get both going, I don't think an upset's out of the question by any means. But I think if you're looking at both teams and wanting to pick who might be a favorite, I think you would take the Steelers because of their tradition and the defense.
Right, and it is a pretty big margin, at least one touchdown that I could see the last time I looked at the odds. Greg, this is a quirky team with a little bit of cross-pollination, at least on the coaching staff, with the Pittsburgh Steelers. What does that mean?
Sure, yeah, it's been interesting. I mean, it gives them a little bit of an advantage because, you know, Coach Ken Wisenhunt and his assistant head coach Russ Grimm were both in Pittsburgh. Are they both familiar with the system and the players? You know, Mike Tomlin got the job in Pittsburgh, and both of them, you know, felt a little bit passed over. So it certainly adds a little intrigue and drama to the week. I think I might have seen about 400 stories or so on this so far. And, it'll be interesting to see, like, how much they can glean from their time in Pittsburgh or whether they'll be able to, you know, write a different ending to that. So definitely one of the better storylines of the week.
You know, the other big story, it seems to me, and it's on the Pittsburgh side, is whether the Steelers will win the Super Bowl without Cowher as the coach. Bill Cowher, of course, left, and, you know, the Steelers, their fortunes haven't been great. They've been a real contender of a team, but here's a chance to really stick it to Cowher. What do you make of that story?
Oh, absolutely. I think one thing about Pittsburgh is they have coaches that stay for a long time, and they really, you know, sort of endear themselves to the fans and make their mark on Steelers history. And, you know, you look at Chuck Noll was there forever, and then Bill Cowher, and now they have Mike Tomlin, and he's sort of writing his own version of Steelers history.
Right.
It'll be interesting if Cowher, what he says, because I'm pretty sure that he'll be, you know, covering the game. But it'll be interesting to see if Tomlin can carry on the tradition.
Yeah, Cowher is a commentator for Fox, is that right?
I think it's CBS.
It's CBS, right. I just don't watch enough football to know that. But I do know this, that if you're in the middle of the press week leading up to the Super Bowl, you have to go to a lot of events. You've already mentioned you've seen 400 stories on this or that storyline. What is the Super Bowl press event that melts your brain?
The worst is Media Day on Tuesday. there are probably, you know, 1,000 or so reporters on one sideline. It's at the stadium, and there are booths with players in them and other players standing next to those booths. And there's a lot of pushing and shoving.
Right.
There was a man wearing a dress this week and asking questions. A couple of years or last year, there's someone, a woman proposed to Tom Brady at Media Day. That funny guy from the Tonight Show, I forget his name, was here this week. I mean, it's just kind of a spectacle. And if you don't allow yourself to enjoy it, you might go crazy.
Did any of the players say, I'm asking you because you're right on the front lines there, did any of the players say, I'm trusting in God and focusing on the business at hand and not worrying about any of the distractions as I think about the game?
Yeah, absolutely.
That would be every player.
I think you could almost say to a man, yes.
Thank you, Greg Bishop, New York Times reporter covering the Super Bowl and taking a look at the quirkiness of the Arizona Cardinals, who are facing the Pittsburgh Steelers in the Super Bowl. Femi Okeh has the headlines.
At 21 minutes to the top of the hour, President Obama's stimulus package is moving on to the Senate. The House passed it last night without any Republican support. In an interview broadcast today on CBS's The Early Show, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said that the House Democrats will take responsibility for the stimulus package's impact.
We have the well-being of the American people at stake, and we're going to do what is best for them. We will be accountable for it.
House Republicans say the bill had too much spending and not enough tax cuts, and President Obama wanted the measure to have bipartisan support. More job cuts were announced today. Kodak announced this morning that it's eliminating at least 3,500 jobs. That's 14% of its payroll. And that comes on top of Starbucks' announcement yesterday that it will cut 6,700 jobs and close more than 300 stores. Middle East Special Envoy George Mitchell is turning his attention to the West Bank today. He's meeting with the Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas, and Mitchell emphasized the importance of maintaining a ceasefire between Hamas and Israel. That's a look at some of the stories making news this morning.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning, everyone. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Adora Udoji is away. So you must have heard the story about Citigroup deciding not to take delivery of its $50 million jet plane. Well, that's not the only corporate perk that's being hit in this economic downturn. The fish are nervous. We alluded to that at the top of the hour. Why? Because the use of aquarium status, high concept aquariums in corporate offices is radically in decline. There's even some legislation that might limit the use of them by people who are accepting TARP money. I kid you not. Joining us now is Casey Carter, financier of Acrylic Tank Manufacturers of Las Vegas and ATM Exhibits. He's the man behind the money in at least one slice of the aquarium industry. Casey Carter, what is this economic downturn doing to you?
Well, it's affecting us greatly because we usually get about a million hits a month on our websites, one of which is acrylicaquariums.com, and the other one is atmexhibits.com. And we used to get a million hits, and now we only get about 800,000 hits, which is about a 20% reduction. What's happened is I am in Puerto Rico right now, and unfortunately, because the fish are nervous, I've taken them on vacation, and I've put them over here with me.
Is Nemo nervous, Casey?
Nemo is very nervous, and he doesn't know where he's going to be next. And hopefully we could find a good home for him.
What's the difference between a corporate kind of status symbol aquarium and the kind of thing my daughter has on a table next to her bed with a couple of little goldfish in it?
Well, one is a bowl, one is a glass tank, and our aquariums are all custom-made, and they're all made out of acrylic to any shape, size that one wants. We build them from 50 gallons all the way up to thousands of gallons, and we do many installations of various panels for museums, for SeaWorlds, for zoos, et cetera, et cetera.
So I imagine you're shifting over to the zoos. And I'm wondering, Casey, if in the heyday when you were installing lots and lots of these at really high prices, did you ever think to yourself, man, this can't continue? This is kind of a aquarium bubble.
Well, like everything else in life, the person that made $100,000 spent $120,000, and therefore they felt they were going to make more money. In this particular industry, we felt the same way, that as business grows and as people see our websites and the more hits we get, the more money we're going to make. And unfortunately, because of the downturn of the economy and the lack of hits that we've gotten, we've had to lay off actually 11 people.
Wow.
Out of about 45 people.
Well, it goes to show that for all this sort of moralizing about corporate jets and no more aquariums and no more perks for corporate CEOs, whatever you believe about that, you know, every perk represents jobs, right?
Yes.
And that's the case for you. You can say that aquariums are frivolous, but the people who actually worked for you didn't think their job was frivolous, right?
Absolutely not.
Well, Casey Carter, good fishing down there in Puerto Rico, and good luck to you, sir.
Well, thank you. You have a wonderful day.
Casey Carter is the financier of Acrylic Tank Manufacturers of Las Vegas, experiencing this recession like everyone else.
Would somebody please give me directions?
Hey, what's the matter?
What's the matter? While they're doing their silly little impressions, I am miles from home with a fish that can't even remember her own name.
Boy, but that's frustrating.
Yeah.
If I could fly like birds on high.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everybody, and we begin with Femi Okeh's final look at the headlines for the morning.
Oh, thank you very much, John. The time is 13 minutes to the top of the hour. New economic indicators came out this morning. The number of people who applied for unemployment rose slightly last week. The total number applying hit an all-time record of 4.8 million. Meanwhile, durable goods orders tumbled for the fifth straight month. Iraq is shutting down Blackwater. Today, the Iraqi government says the private military company can no longer operate in Iraq, and that's a potential challenge to the US. The American government pays a Blackwater to protect many diplomats in Iraq, and Iraq says that it's kicking out Blackwater for excessive force. And the highest profile controversy for the company came with its involvement in a 2007 shooting where 17 Iraqi civilians died. Governor Rod Blagojevich makes his first appearance at his own impeachment trial, and that will be in Illinois today. It's been going on all week, but Blagojevich hasn't shown up at all. He says it's been an unfair trial and he won't be sworn in and won't answer questions, but he does get 90 minutes to make a closing argument. And the Illinois Lieutenant General Pat Quinn is going to be in Springfield today to take over in case Blagojevich is ousted. And a new study says that chemicals commonly found in upholstery and carpets could damage women's fertility. And researchers studied over 1,200 women, and they found that infertility was linked with higher concentrations of the chemicals known as PFCs in the bloodstream. And PFCs are usually found in products varying from food packaging to shampoo, so they're really difficult to avoid.
Indeed.
Let's look at some of the stories making news this morning.
Thanks a lot, Femi. So Washington is rightly probably obsessed with all these stimulus plans and bailouts, but we're going to have to get to the future eventually, beyond the bailouts. And if we're thinking about that, we need to look to the past. What got us out of recessions in the 1980s? Well, that was the tech bubble. How about the recession in the 1930s? That was World War II. David Leonhardt is contemplating what is the engine that's going to drive the U.S. economy, maybe even the global economy, out of this economic downturn. And looking at history, is it much of a guide? David Leonhardt is a New York Times columnist and writer of the economics blog at the New York Times. He joins us from Detroit. David, thanks for joining us.
Good morning, John.
Are you having trouble finding an engine that at the end of the day, beyond stimulus, beyond bank bailouts, is going to actually drive the U.S. economy into the next phase?
One of the hard things about this question is we all want to know what's next, what's going to replace what we just had, and it's in some ways it's an unanswerable question. I don't think we can pick exactly what the industry of tomorrow is. A lot of people want to pick green jobs, which could help, but it seems hard to see how it's going to drive the whole economy. What seems to have worked in the past is a pretty active role alongside the private sector for the government in making investments. And it's funny, the government does a lot of things pretty poorly. There's no doubt about that. But if you look at some of the basic investments it's made, it built the internet, it built the highway system, it in many ways built the modern biotechnology industry through NIH grants.
Right.
It really has an excellent record in making some sort of basic investments. And the amount of investing that our government does in these sorts of things has declined really rapidly between the 1950s and now.
Is the government responsible for the current electrical grid, the technology of which is so criticized as being outdated and vulnerable to, catastrophic shutdown?
You know, I'm not a grid expert, so I don't know. I do know that the stimulus bill has some money in it, a fair amount of money, actually, to deal with the electrical grid. I don't know whether that's to help the private sector or whether it's the government itself.
Well, certainly electric projects in the West were a big part of the so-called stimulus package in the 1930s.
Absolutely. And I think there are all kinds of good examples of things the government doesn't run well. I mean, people like to complain about airline deregulation. Airline deregulation has been an enormous success. Flying is incredibly cheaper. Flying is incredibly safe. It's a lot safer than it used to be. If you want to sort of recreate the grand old days of flying, you can do it by flying first class and, just like back then, paying a huge amount of money.
But let's talk about that deregulation legacy for a moment. I mean, on some level, the deregulation moment caused a lot of the really bad excesses of the regulatory environment to go away. And we had competition and prices fell. And you're right, safety, was improved. But I think at a certain point, the airline industry kind of went off the cliff and there are all kinds of service problems. There was nothing to sort of stop the industry from its own excess, whether you're talking about capacity or a competition that just drove prices into the dirt.
Well, I actually think airlines are a nice example. One of the things I argue for in this piece in this Sunday's magazine is that we have much more of an investment economy and much less of a consumption economy. I mean, the consumption economy is going away no matter what. And so the question is, can we build something like an investment economy? I think private companies are just in a much better situation to set prices and pick routes than the government.
I see.
What private companies can't do is invest in a modern air traffic system.
Right.
And so I think a lot of the problems that you see now in the airline system, I'm about to get on an airline myself, and now it'll probably be late in exchange for my having praised the system, come from the fact that we've underinvested in things like the air traffic system. And that is not something that private companies are able to do.
So I see. So if the government had increased its investment in the sort of infrastructure that allows the airline to function, we wouldn't really be having these capacity problems, and the excess, as I call it, would actually not feel like excess. It would just feel like more service.
I think that's right.
Really?
I mean, look, airlines were always going to make a transition from a luxury good to a mass good. And so to people who got to enjoy it when it was a luxury good, who were rich enough to fly back in the 50s and 60s, you would imagine that they would complain, right? Because we all like a luxury vehicle instead of a bus. But the fact is that most of that transition is simply about the airlines becoming something that millions of people can use. The delays and stuff, I think, are actually fixable.
Well, let's enlarge this out from the airlines then to the big fix, as you describe in your article that's in the Sunday's New York Times. I mean, is the big fix going to come from government, or is it going to come from the private sector when we get on the other side of whatever this economic downturn turns out to be?
I think one of the big lessons of this crisis and this crash is that government plays an indispensable role. That doesn't mean it runs the economy. That doesn't even mean it needs to be as involved as the European governments are in the European economy. But the government we've had has not been involved enough. It allowed all these terrible things to go on in the financial system, which then in turn forced the government to get more involved than we should want it. And so I think the government does play an absolutely vital role in a number of places. Education is one of them. There is no better bet for economic growth than education. I mean, you could look at nearly any measure. If you can look at states, you can look at countries. Places that tend to get more educated later on tend to get more affluent and healthier. And healthcare is another one. I mean, we're already incredibly involved in healthcare, we being the taxpayers, through Medicare. The problem is we're not involved in a very smart way. We pay for all these treatments that are hugely expensive, and actually, when you look at the evidence, don't do all that much to make people healthier. And so my hope is that some of this this moment we're going through will be a reconsideration of the role that government needs to play in both a smart way and a little bit larger way.
Very quickly before we go, and I mean this, does the debt that we've acquired and the leveraging of the financial sector put a damper on getting to that place that you talk about in the Big Fix?
Not much of one. We're going to end up with a debt-to-GDP ratio of maybe 60% in a couple of years. After World War II, it was above 100%, and we all look back at the 50s and 60s as the golden age of economics. We can grow with this level of debt.
What do you know? Some happy talk from David Leonhard.
Yeah, exactly.
Reporter for the New York Times. He wrote the article for this Sunday's magazine called The Big Fix. Joined us from Detroit. Get on that plane now, David.
Thanks, John.
That's what I love about Leonhard. He just yanks a nugget right out of there. So another upside of tough economic times is that we hear some big ticket items are coming down in price. That's positive. Sometimes as much as 70%. So we've been asking you all morning to tell us where to find the sales and the deals. Now, not everyone thinks prices are coming down.
Hi, this is Randy, and I'm from Washington. Currently active duty in the military, and actually one of the best deals that we have on right now for us as far as discount-wise at Disney World. The active duty members free, and five family members can get a five-day park hopper ticket for $99. So pretty impressive. Haven't seen that in a while. Actually, I've never seen that.
If you're traveling, that's good news. But prices are going up in other places.
Just for the heck of it, I called Continental Airlines, and I checked on a couple of locations that I might be interested in, and the prices did not change. As a matter of fact, the prices went up. So this stuff about prices going down, in my opinion, is a lot of balagna. Thank you.
Or baloney, depending on what you see in your town. But what are you really seeing? And do some reporting for us. Are you seeing deals? Prices going up? Are prices looking like they're going up but not actually going up? You can call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or MYTAKE at thetakeaway.org. And once again, your takeaway from inside the Beltway.
I was surprised that the Republicans were unanimous in rejecting it. I knew there was strong feeling against the process and the content of the bill, but I expected some Republicans would vote for it.
That's Republican Michigan Congressman Vernon Ehlers talking about the stimulus bill that passed last night, as he said, unanimously without a single Republican voting for it. We're always on. If you missed anything, including that interview with Congressman Ehlers, take our podcast to go. You can subscribe at thetakeaway.org or iTunes. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.